The FNRAD Snowboard Podcast is presented by Vans. Season 6 of FNRAD is sponsored by Wired Snowboards, The Boardroom Snowboard Shop, Anon Optics, Ocean Rose Organics, and Crow's Nest Barbershops, Tribute Board Shop in Nelson, BC, and Stance Socks. Stance makes technical snowboarding socks that keep your feet warm and dry with Feel 360 technology, a proprietary fiber treatment that adapts and reacts to the foot to create the freshest and driest comfort experience. Feel 360 reacts to eliminate 99.95% of odor-causing bacteria. It adapts to body temperature to keep feet warm and wicks away sweat. Premium twisted yarn makes Stance socks durable and long-lasting, and the result is the most durable, best-performing, and most comfortable socks on the market. Wearing Stance socks while snowboarding unlocks the full potential of the boots you paid hundreds of dollars for. So do yourself a favor, go and buy a pair of Stance socks. Support also comes from Grouse Mountain, Mount Seymour, and Tomahawk Indigenous Cannabis Extracts. All right, FNRAD listeners, this week's guest is legendary backcountry heavy hitter Brian Savard. He was a professional for K2 snowboards back when a professional snowboarder could easily put in over 40 days a year in a helicopter. His powerful style was featured in the TB movie series, and you'd see him all the time in the pages of Trans World and Snowboarder magazine. He got to go on trips to India and even Iran with Craig Kelly. I reached him at his home on Vancouver Island, where he works now as a skate park designer and builder.
You know, since you called me, it's kind of been a flush of memories coming back. Yeah, it was a pretty amazing time in my life for sure.
Yeah, man, of course. So you grew up in Port. Would you have had to, I mean, I know a little bit about Mount Arrowsmith. I know that there was a hill that they built a chairlift down on on a really, really good snow year, and then it never snowed that far down again. And
yeah,
you had to go through some mud to get onto the chair or something. Would you have ever gone there?
Yeah, you got the story right. So yeah, they kind of blew it. I guess they had no snow history there, so they built the lift way too low on the mountain. And then I think after a couple seasons, they realized there was no snow there. But I rode that probably 3 or 4 times growing up as a young child. I was like 8 or 10, and we skied it. That was prior to snowboarding, but that was an interesting time. And then of course they moved up to the higher elevation, and they put a couple few hours in up there.
Cool.
And that was viable for a few years.
Nice.
And that's actually the first place I started snowboarding.
Oh, that's amazing. Did they have a rental program? Were you on a rental board, or was it a borrowed board?
No, it wasn't a borrowed board. I bought a snowboard before I'd ever snowboarded. I called around trying to figure out where I could get a snowboard, and someone said, oh, there's a snowboard shop in Calgary. And so I called up the snowboard shop and got Ken Achenbach on the phone. And I ordered myself a Sims half pipe.
Amazing.
And he shipped it out. And I'm like, well, I was skateboarding a lot prior to that. So, you know, I was a vert skater and a street skater and really into board sports. And then as soon as I saw snowboarding come out, I'm like, oh, I have to get on that.
Rad.
And, yeah. So
I think Jim Barnum said you built your own vert ramp in your yard. Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, that is so sick, dude. Did you have plans or?
16, no. We just figured it out. You know, we built enough little kickers and quarter pipes and stuff like that. You know, through our trials and successes, we figured out, you know, how to build a ramp, and eventually got to the vert ramp stage. And it was small. It was only 8 feet tall by about 12 feet wide, but it was kind of the first iteration. And then it grew over the years. We tore it down and rebuilt it. And it ended up being 10 foot by 16 by the time it was done. And then, it was pretty interesting. We were, you know, kind of in a city lot, and it was a monstrosity in the backyard, and it got a lot of attention, but it was a lot of fun. We had all the kids in the neighborhood over all the time. And everyone learning how to skate and learning how to blast airs and inverts and whatever. So it was a good time. It was really nice that my parents supported that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah,
parents would have been like, "What the hell are you doing?"
Yeah, supported like the whole like skate community. I can remember guys who would have a skateboard ramp, and really you couldn't say no to any skaters that came. You know what I mean? Like, it was like all of a sudden you're kind of responsible for, you know, the culture of skateboarding in your community.
Yeah, it was like that. It was, we, you know, we were pioneering. We didn't really have a clue what we were doing yet. You know, we were exploring it and making new friends and testing our skills and abilities along the way. And it was a neat experience for sure.
Yeah. Barnum saying that there's like a shorthand to, like, you know, a skateboarder's ability level, and the fact that you could do inverts on a vert ramp that you built is like shorthand for like, he was good.
it was interesting because we could watch videos, but it wasn't like you could, you know, there was anyone better than us and we could watch and kind of emulate. It was, yeah, all it was us just going out there and flailing around until we figured out how to do stuff. And it's, I guess it's much like any of the pro skaters of the day, you know, all over America and California. It was like, okay, well, those guys had to figure it out too. So I was like, we got to do the same.
Yeah. Yeah. California seemed to be like it seemed like there was a lot more skateboarding going on. There were parks and things. Like, I can remember, I mean, where I grew up, there was no park. Then the local shop built like a kind of mini ramp park in the shop. It was insane. Yeah. It was all do it yourself stuff. Someone built a blast ramp and you'd go over and ring the doorbell. Can we take your blast ramp out in the middle of the street and air to flat, please?
Yes, I lived that for a long time.
That's fun. So the first snowboard that you get from Ken Ock, that is just, that's classic. That's amazing. And it shows up and you bring it to Aerosmith. And were you able to do it right away because you had a background in skateboarding?
It did translate pretty easy. Mm-hmm. You know, the lifts weren't open when I went up there, so we were only hiking. Mm-hmm. I think it showed up after the hill had shut for the season. And so we went up and built a few jumps, and we'd hike up and just blast off whatever we could. And I instantly fell in love with it. And, you know, the story just went on from there. We were in, just to back up half a second.
Yeah.
You know, to try and understand what early snowboarding was like in British Columbia and on Vancouver Island, access was limited. We had Aerosmith, which was kind of at the tail end of its operational lifespan. Mm-hmm. So we had limited season up there, and then you had Mount Washington that at the time didn't even allow snowboarding.
Oh, wow.
And we had another now defunct resort, family resort called Forbidden Plateau.
Oh, yeah.
Which fully embraced snowboarding. And, you know, and so after Aerosmith kind of finished its, its lifespan, I think everyone who was snowboarding on the island transitioned to Forbidden Plateau. And that's where, you know, I, you know, met some lifelong friends there, and we developed our snowboarding on that little hill, and it was a lot of fun. And then eventually Mount Washington opened up, but, you know, that's kind of another story with a couple of trial days with us up there with our snowboards getting poked at with ski poles and told to get off the mountain. And we were not, there was no love there.
You were there for trial days. Like, you're not exaggerating. There was actually like, they're like, okay, we're going to let you guys go this weekend. And then we're going to go back to the boardroom and decide yay or nay on this. Wow.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, we were the guinea pigs for that whole program up there. And I think, you know, they understood after a while, if they didn't embrace snowboarding, they were going to lose a big part of the snow sport industry. So they got on board eventually.
Snowboarding showed up at established, you know, ski areas around the world have been established. It's this new thing. So, of course, you're going to be like, we hate that thing. One thing I never thought of before was that snowboarding was instantly better in powder. So you could be like a beginner snowboarder, but better than like a seasoned skier in powder, because the boards just floated so well compared to the like no side cut, you know, sticks that people were on in the late 80s. It was like really that would have just been a adding insult to injury, right? Like, first of all, you don't want the guys on there. They're falling, getting off the chairlift, and you're going like, this will never stick. And then you see them in powder and you have to admit like, oh, that looks way more fun than what we're doing.
Oh, yeah. Well, and you can just see the curve of the snowboard industry take off, mm-hmm. you know, with that, you know, with those kind of, I don't know, when you talk about how much easier it is to snowboard in powder, and then we were on a resort that, you know, it snows all the time. It's kind of a deep powder place, mm-hmm. like Mount Baker and any of the North Shore mountains. And so, you know, you're going to get a lot of fresh snow all the time. So it made sense to be on a snowboard out here.
How did the trial go? Did they come back and say, oh yeah, these guys know how to turn and stop. That's fine.
Yeah. You know what? We came into it. We were rebellious. You know, we were kind of punks, and we stirred the pot a little bit for sure. We weren't going to take any shit from anybody on the mountain. And so, you know, we just went up there, we did our thing, and they were checking for leashes, and, you know, they wanted to make sure that snowboards didn't fall off the chairlift, mm-hmm. or like we didn't lose them while going down the mountain. And we had some kind of control while we were going around on the hill. So they observed a little bit. It was kind of fun.
Yeah.
And then I think they quickly realized that, you know, this sport was not going anywhere. They were here to stay.
Yeah. Year after year, there'd be more. Like, I can remember, I guess it would probably be around 88, 89 that I started going to resorts. And like, yeah, the first two or three years, you know, if you didn't know every snowboarder there by the end of the day, you did. And then, you know, by the time I moved out here in 1993, you know, it was 20-30% snowboarders already. Like, that's only a couple of years, and it was definitely a giant curve in participation.
Yeah. Yeah. And like you say, you're meeting everyone on the mountain, and everyone's, you know, coming from kind of a like-minded background, mm-hmm. and it just became an amazing community.
Yeah, you started competing. I that was one of the other things Barnum said. He said he saw you up at Camp of Champions one summer, and he'd never seen anyone that wasn't, you know, like a skinny skate rat kid. You were like actually, you know, like, you know, athletic. And they maybe gave you the gears for a little bit, but then once they saw you shredding, they're like, holy shit, this guy is really good. And then you start winning contests and everything, right? So they would see you at all the BCA contests all around. Or BCSA.
Yeah, I had a love for it. You know, mm-hmm. as soon as I got on that board, I'm like, this is my thing. I'm like, found a passion that I want to go as long and as far as I can doing this sport. And, you know, I just wanted to go have adventures and explore with my snowboard. And it took me, you know, I wanted to kind of make some inroads. So I decided, you know, I'd go from Vancouver Island over the mainland and compete in some events and just, you know, meet some new snowboarders, learn some new tricks, and, you know, mm-hmm. have some fun.
Rad. So who are the first guys that you wind up crewing up with? Do you create a crew, and like, do you move to Whistler or something like that? Or do you just do the commute thing?
Well, I was still commuting from the island. The first year after graduation, we moved to Cumberland, mm-hmm. British Columbia, and we kind of based ourselves in Mount Washington.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we had Jeremy Atkinson was there.
Rad.
Javin Walker was there.
Cool.
So we just kind of pushed each other, you know, through riding every day together. We just wanted to make ourselves better. And you know, then we, you know, that hill's quite small, limited terrain, and we outgrew it pretty quick.
Mm-hmm.
And we quickly realized that we had set our sights on Whistler, and that was where we all ended up getting up to. And so, you know, the next year, went to summer camp, and then, which was crazy, because we had all the pros from around the world showing up there, and it was just really neat to sort of see what was going on in snowboarding and all the rest. And I think coming from the island too, you know, we didn't know how good we had to be compared to the rest of the world, so I think we tried extra hard in a way.
Yeah.
You know, you're coming from a limited pocket of snowboarders, and you watch videos, you watch magazines, and then you go, okay, well, man, we gotta do better than that.
Yeah.
And then you get up there and you realize that you know, you're on par with some of the best pros in the world. You're like,
that's
whoa, what's going on here? I'm like, these guys aren't nearly as good as they present themselves sometimes, you know?
And, right.
And it was just the way it was, you know? I was like, some were obviously insane, but, you know, then those are the ones we had to aspire to, you know, get as good as or whatever, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So did you move, you moved into Whistler proper? Like, what year would that be? Like 92, 93-ish?
92.
Yeah.
92. I was tree planting in the summertime.
Perfect.
You know, had to make enough money to survive a winter. So
yeah,
we tree plant through the spring and summer, and then get back up to Whistler in the fall, and then hopefully had enough cash to last the season.
So you would have gone through a few boards in that early phase from the Sims. What kind of jumps did you make?
Well, with Sims half pipe, I went. I had a Safari at some point.
Oh,
I don't
wow.
know why. Yeah, and I was riding on that. It was really fun. It was a giant plank, but it was super fun for a while.
Yeah.
And then I had a couple of Libtecs.
Oh, nice.
I think I had a Matt Cummings.
Oh, that's sick. Yeah. Would that have been through the boardroom guys and like a small sponsorship kind of thing?
That was a small sponsorship with on Vancouver Island. Like, there was a couple of sponsors that we got picked up by HTO in Victoria.
HTO, that's right.
Yeah, myself and Jeremy Atkinson. And
cool.
They were early supporters of our snowboarding, which was awesome. You know, it was amazing that they wanted to support us. And so there was, you know what, there was an Avalanche run in there too.
Yeah.
So there was a couple opportunities to meet and ride with Damian Sanders.
Come on. That's amazing.
Yeah.
No way.
So yeah, that was really cool. Yeah. I love that. So we went down to California, we went to Colorado, we did a couple of events and different things, and they helped support us
Holy
to do those
crap.
Things. So, yeah.
What
so
we, what you know, era of so Avalanche cool. is that? The twin tip board with the fluorescent A on either end? Or was it still like the Damien Kick years?
No, it was the Dagger.
The Dagger years. Oh my God. That's insane.
I know. It's like half of this, you know what, Eric, it's hard to remember.
Yeah. No, I mean, we're talking 30 years ago for sure.
I wish I would have kept a scrapbook or had taken more photographs along the way. Cause you know, you're kind of just starting to jog my memory with half of the things that we did and experienced
the
along
trip
the way. So
to California, you would have gone down to Lake Tahoe then and got to witness like how amazing that is so early on in the thing. And be there with Damien.
Yeah.
You got to ride Tahoe with Damien in the 90s. Like, that's just incredible. That's insane. I love that.
Yeah. So it was really cool. You know, like that was, my eyes were opened, you know, here we are like having the ability and the opportunity to ride with, you know, the best riders in the world at the time. And it's like, okay, I want to be there too. I want to do this. And then, you know, here we are.
So
30 years later, just
so you, when you went to camp the first year, you were a camper, like you paid to go as a camper, or were you helping as a digger?
No, that was my graduation gift.
Oh, that's
my parents.
So sweet.
So sent me to summer camp, Camp of Champions, and that was really cool.
Incredible. So did you get to meet Ken in real life and be like, hey, I ordered my first board from you?
Yeah, it was the first time I met Ken, and now we've become lifelong friends. So,
oh, that's great.
That was the first introduction.
Yeah, he's.
I'm sure.
I rode with him this year. He is one of my favorite characters in the history of snowboarding, you know, in the world.
Yeah,
he's been at so many, you know, important moments in snowboarding, and it makes me smile to think of, you know, Ken being there talking with Jake Burton or Tom Sims or Chuck Barfoot, you know, like, and really affecting the trajectory of these brands. It's incredible. He's so rad.
He is. You know what? He was such a supporter. of mm-hmm. all of it, you mm-hmm. know. He had such a stoke for it. And then creating the camp, you know, I don't know how many guys came through his camp, whether it be pros or actual campers, mm-hmm. that, you know, went on to have pro careers in snowboarding. So, you know, he really did a service to the industry and to the sport, you know, with all of his efforts.
Absolutely.
So all the athletes he supported, you know, and then, you know, also his photography.
Yep.
So he, you know, I think we all kind of, there's a bit of a debt of gratitude to, you know, what his contribution's been to the sport.
Yeah. Just being that pioneering spirit, you know, there's stories of him piling kids into his van and driving them to go snowboarding, like literally introducing guys like John Boyer to, you know, the thing that's going to change his life. It's so cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, it's incredible.
He's like a father figure, you know, it's just like, you know, he's the guy that, you know, coached the team or just kind of held the jello together.
Yeah.
Half together.
Totally. So your first sponsor is HTO with Avalanche, and then, cause the Matt Cummins board is pretty, like, that's a pretty good board. That would have been pretty sick, especially coming from a Dagger that was like, you know, an ironing board with really aggressive side cut and crazy hips and stuff.
Yeah. And so stiff. It had no flex. It literally was just the stiffest board you could ever imagine. It was, it was a Dagger.
Yeah. So you learned to go fast on it, probably.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then,
but you know, I've actually never really lost my love for having stiff snowboards.
Oh, that's crazy. Awesome. You know,
From early riding, like as soon as I got on a board that was too soft, I just tended to overpower it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the trend in the industry was, it was interesting because, you know, when I finally landed on K2, they were a lot of offerings, but I was always pushing for a stiffer, heavier board, but the industry always tended to go to like the softer, more forgiving, flexier sort of models. And I was like, oh, I can't even really ride these things. They just kind of wash out on me. And so I actually had, they built custom cores for me at the end of the day.
Oh, that's amazing.
Douglas fir was my go-to core, but it was like, we can't even market this, Brian. No one's going to want the boards that you want. It was pretty interesting,
Did you push for the Doug fir? Like, was that something that you knew would have the kind of core characteristics that you wanted, or did they just say, oh, Douglas fir is the stiffest wood that we use?
Well, balsa was kind of the go-to with carbon stringers.
Yeah.
With an ultra light, but the fir had a lot more weight, and it actually has a lot more spring to it.
Yeah.
So it wanted to rebound to its shape a lot faster, a lot better.
Rad.
And they didn't break, and they actually felt like there was a bit of board underneath your feet when, you know, when you're in the air or you're rotating, it just had its own mass to kind of help counterbalance what you were doing.
Yeah.
I found like super light boards didn't offer enough, you know, I don't know what it would be like a ballast,
yeah.
I guess would be a good word to describe it. And I was on the heavier side in terms of a rider, you know, as you mentioned earlier, I was not the twiggy skate punk coming into snowboarding. I was, you know, was a little heftier.
Were you working out and stuff? Was it like, were you like kind of a jock snowboarder, let's say?
No, I think I was just built differently.
Okay.
You know, I grew up the son of a mason, and my dad had me packing bricks up scaffolding.
Yep.
From the time I was about 13 years old.
Yeah.
And so
that'll do
it. I think that it just, you know, developed my physique, and that was like, okay, I got this. I may as well use it.
And yeah.
Yeah.
Well, your time on K2 is fascinating to me too, because you're on the team. Kevin Young is on the team. Sean Farmer is on the team. Nick Parada's on the team. So you have a lot in common with Farmer as far as like big mountain stuff, and with KY, like essentially you guys are very similar riders. He's maybe a little more freestyle, oriented and you're a bit more big mountain, does that come about because of a choice, or does that come about because you get on to some of these Alaska trips and you're like, well, if I'm in Alaska, I'm going to be doing big lines?
Well, I was thinking about it the other night. I'm like, I guess I could be most defined as a big mountain rider,
mm-hmm.
but I did truly come from more of a freestyle background.
Yeah, of course.
With
you're
my
a skater.
Sporting, with my half pipe. I had competed in more half pipe events and more big air events through my career than I can remember.
Right.
And, you know, had some really good successes there. And I thought, you know, really honestly, I thought I was going to end up having a career in freestyle. That's where I was planning to make my home in the sport. And then, Kevin was there, Farmer was there. I was doing a lot of big mountain backcountry stuff. And I ended up just falling in love with that kind of riding over the years. It's like, K2 kind of wanted me there and I kind of ended up wanting to be there as well.
Yeah,
so it worked out. It worked out in the end. And that's where there was just so much more adventure to be found. In that kind of mountain riding. And then it turned into travel after that. So, we were based in North America, the early part of the sport. And then all of a sudden, we were starting to take snowboarding to the world. And that's when it got really awesome and really interesting.
That's so rad. So how many years on K2 do you do? Was that, I don't know.
Oh, it was almost my entire career,
Right.
It was from the time I moved to Whistler within a couple of years, I ended up hooking up with Eric Berger.
Yep.
Who was, one of the leading photographers at the time. And he had a strong relationship with K2. And he's like, I was in between sponsors. I kind of bounced around a little bit. I was on Division 23 for a little bit.
Oh, wow.
I was, kind of had my feelers out for where I could find a spot. And then he's like, oh, I'll just ride one of these K2s I got and we'll take some photos. And so we went down to Mount Baker, met some of the K2 guys there, was riding one of their boards, and they're like, oh yeah, we want you on the team. So they made me an offer, and I guess, that was it.
What board would you have been riding? Would it be like one of those HCs, like the hardcore or whatever it was?
It was either that or the Eldorado.
Yeah, I think the Eldorado came after that. Like, I think those HCs were like, I don't think they had a full wood core. I think they were like foam and wood. So they would have been really light. And then the full wood core would have been more your, like you say, like better for you riding big mountains.
You might be right. I think it was probably the HC. It had a K2 logo on it. Maybe one of the kind of on each end, the tail and the nose.
I
can't remember exactly.
Those were beautiful boards at that time. K2 was killing it. Yeah. And it had like kind of a diamond nose shape. Like it wasn't just like boring.
Yeah.
And
That's right.
Yeah. They were good.
For reminding me. Yeah. That's exactly what it was.
Yeah. They were a lot of fun. And then, so during your time there, those soft little boards you're talking about, like the Daniel Frank and the Juju, like, they went really small. Like, I could remember wanting Juju. I think the biggest it came in was either 52 or 54 or something. Like, they were just little noodle boards.
Yeah, they were.
Yeah.
They were hard to ride.
Yeah, sure. Of course. Because the jumps were getting too big for those little boards. That was a thing.
Yeah, I preferred the Fat Bob myself.
Oh, yeah, right. I can think of some iconic shots of you, some burger shots of you on a Fat Bob too. Yeah, man.
Yeah.
That would have been just such a fun time. So do they pick your brain for design stuff at that point? Or are you just like, how does a contract work at that point? Is it mostly photo incentives? Are you getting a monthly paycheck so that you can ride all winter? You don't have to.
Yeah.
Tree plant in the summer?
There was a retainer in place by then. Yeah, I transitioned out of working off seasonally into full-time snowboarding in about, I guess, 94.
Rad.
By my recollection.
Yeah.
it could have been between 93 and 94 sometime. And then, you know, it was just full-time riding at that point. And, it, you know, which consisted of going to South America in the summertime early on.
Yeah.
You know, I think I've been to Chile and Argentina about 7 or 8 times.
Awesome.
Over those years. Yeah. And so, yeah, it was just full-time snowboarding. And then there was, to answer your question, yeah, there was a lot of development that was happening with the team. Mm-hmm. They were bringing us in all the time with the designers and engineers and trying to improve the product. I think they were good at kind of advancing technology and wanted to progress the sport. I loved the team. Like, the people involved at K2 were awesome. Luke Edgar and Haley. And it was a fun time to be in snowboarding in general, really. Cause, you know, here it is. There's a sport that's gone from, you know, not being allowed at a resort to becoming, you know, a multi-million dollar industry within a matter of, you know, 3 years, and, you know, giving skiing a run for its money. And we're on the wave, you know. I'm watching it all happen real time in front of me and getting to ride with the best riders in the world. And, you know, it was just an amazing adventure.
Yeah. What was the first trip that you went on where you were like, holy shit, they're paying for this whole thing? I'm like a full-on legit sponsored rider now. It sounds like you went to Baker and they saw you ride and they were like, you need to be on our boards.
Yeah, it was like that. And then they're like, okay, well, we'll get you on board. And then they were sponsoring movies. So then they made a connection with me to, you know, I think it was one of the first, Adventure Scope was there at the time. And I started riding and doing some filming with Adventure Scope. But what was the name of that company out of Alberta? It was James Angrove.
Was that Rap Films?
Rap Films.
Yeah.
Yeah. K2 said, oh, yeah, we're sponsoring Rap Films. We want you to go to Alaska.
Oh, wow.
And it was really, really cool because it was a mixed ski snowboard trip.
Yeah.
And I was, you know what? I didn't know crap about the backcountry or big mountain riding. And it was such a good introduction for me because I was up there with Trevor Peterson, Eric Bohota, a bunch of the absolute ski legends at the time.
Sick.
And then that was schooling for me, man. Those guys introduced me to what mountain riding was all about and mountain safety, because, you know, that was a huge component that I picked up along the way, is how to be safe in that environment. And, you know, getting thrown into helicopters and riding around in insane terrain, you really had to have your head on your shoulders and your wits about you. And, you know, they introduced me to like how to pick terrain and how to, you know, how to be safe out there and how to set stuff up. So if something does go wrong, you know, you got people in position that are trained enough to rescue you and do avalanche searches properly. And that was super key to learn all that stuff early on from some experienced skiers. And then, you know, I was able to take that knowledge and go with it into snowboarding. And that was really, really great first introduction.
Oh, that's incredible. So would you guys ride with packs, peeps, probe, shovel, that kind of thing? Or
everyone had to have their stuff because we were all cycling through, right? It was like, okay, it's your turn. You pick your line. And then, you know what, you just made sure that you were in position that if something went down, you could get to them properly and perform a search if required. So it was, everyone had to be prepared out there. And, you know, it came into focus later on, you know, in my career when I was out doing stuff, if I didn't feel confident of the abilities of the people I was with, I would start limiting what I would do.
Right.
If I was out with a crew that was like somewhat experienced in backcountry train and this and that, and I just noticed that, you saw all kinds of things happen through the years. You know, we spent so many hours in the backcountry in helicopters and snowmobiles that, you know, when I knew I had support around me, that's when things really clicked. And I was like, okay, today's the day we're really going to push it. Cause you know, I've got guys like Sheen Campos looking out, on my back, and Curtis Croy and those guys, and the Swede, legendary heli guide. That was when we had stuff set up the right way. It was like, okay, today's going to be a big day. We're going to push, because everyone knew that we can look after each other. So it was good. It was interesting.
That's rad. Yeah. Riding to the conditions, which include the group that you're with. Yeah, I could totally see that.
Yeah.
But there was no groundwork laid for that before you guys were doing it. Like, you were the first group of snowboarders that were just, you know, coming up with this buddy system. So yeah, you would have been on some trips where you're there with people that you don't know or trust as much, and just be like, okay, well, whatever. I'm not putting my life on the line for this, you know, photo shoot.
I will say you had to get scared a few times to know the importance of it. Yeah. So it's only now that I can reflect on it and say, okay, yeah, that was interesting, because we had, you know, we had a number of close calls along the way. So it's, you know, you can look back and go, okay, hey, this is really important.
Yeah.
Until Mother Nature slaps you around. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. The more you know, the less you go. That's like, that just is, I'm learning that now 30 years later. Like, I've always been a local mountain guy. So like, you kind of get used to the zones that rip, and you kind of know the snow conditions off by heart, you know, like you've been there in those conditions before. But as soon as you get on a snowmobile and you're out in the, like, the Whistler backcountry, it to me is just so gripping the whole time. I just put out a interview I did with Gwynn Howitt from Baker.
Yeah.
And in that I said, I can never get a snowmobile because I just would never say no, but now I can. I wouldn't go on the day. You know what I mean?
Well, it sounds like you've developed a healthy respect for the mountains, which is good.
I hope so. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a dangerous sport. And until I started doing interviews with professional snowboarders, I hadn't really ever thought of how many people have lived through some sort of tragedy, either a friend or a guide or someone very close to them passing away in some tragic, huge snow moving event. It's crazy.
Mm-hmm. I know. Yeah. And we were in that day to day after day after day. That was the environment I spent the majority of my career in.
Wow.
Yeah. And you know what? It's interesting, Eric. You know, I started thinking about it, and I'm like, you really do develop almost an innate sense for what's going on with the snow when you spend that many hours on it.
Mm-hmm.
And you're cruising around and you see the snowpack from the beginning of the season and all the way through and all the events, and you start to really understand what it's like and what's going on. And then, you know, and how it feels underfoot, you know, when you're riding.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I was thinking how many times I'd be like riding a line, and we were all set up to do this thing, and all of a sudden I'll just stop in the middle of the line because it didn't feel right. I'm like, something's wrong. I would stop and literally stop in my tracks, and right there at the edge of my board, a crown would start and an avalanche would fall away from me.
Oh, wow.
Just like that.
And yeah.
It's like instinct or gut or something was just saying, hey, you know what? This isn't right. And I was like, this is what happens when you get good at what you do.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's almost like almost one of the more underrated elements of being in the backcountry and being a snowboarder, is like truly understanding the environment you're in. I almost feel like that was a greater skill in some ways than the actual snowboarding, because of the connection we made with that environment we were working in and living in all the time. I'm like, I know in some ways I'm more proud of those moments then, because they could have, or probably would have resulted in death.
Right.
I'm like, those were bigger achievements in a way than any of the other accomplishments that I ever got out of snowboarding for me. I'm like, trying to keep it real, you know?
Right. Yeah, no, I totally, you know, you're blowing my mind. I'm thinking of how many people have spent that much time out in the backcountry and still, like, so then you get this brotherhood of you know, Alaska guides and backcountry riders with a healthy respect for Mother Nature. And some guys still go down every year. Somebody who's, you know, like skilled in the backcountry and has those senses. It's just like it can happen in the blink of an eye. And no preparation can save you from you know, it's that dangerous. That's the other part of the realization that everybody's been, you know, witness to something gnarly is that also there I can't think of any other sport that is that dangerous that frequently, right? Like you're out in the backcountry day after day after day after day, you know? And sometimes getting too familiar with, you know, with how it was yesterday, it can give you a false confidence. You go on some slope that's been wind blown overnight or whatever, and then all of a sudden you're in a completely different environment. Sucks.
Yeah. It was insane, you know?
Yeah.
And it all it took was letting your guard down for 1 second. And it was like, okay, this could go wrong. Luckily for me, it didn't. It was close. It was a number of occasions that it was like really close. So, and I don't know if it's my age now that's making me reflect on my mortality, maybe.
Right.
But it's like, wow. You know, when you're young, you just don't even realize how potentially close you were.
Yeah. Yeah.
So many times, and you just feel indestructible. And then, you know, as you get older, and it's weird, you know, it's so many years now after the fact. And it's like I can finally process it and reflect on all of it, mm-hmm. and kind of put it in its place, which is interesting. It's taken years, though.
I could imagine, yeah, because when you're coming up, you're trying to get sponsors first of all, and then once you get them, you want to please the sponsors. And like you said, you were driven from movies and magazines. You're like, I want to be one of the best in the world at this. So to be the best in the world, you're pushing your limits constantly. And so while you're pushing your limits, there's an acceptable amount of risk that you're willing to take. Like, oh, well, you know, maybe I'll get hurt on this one, but probably not. I got this, you know, like, and then as you get the sponsorship and you're getting the money, and then I imagine down the road as a family starts, you start to look at it differently. Like, well, these companies are making a lot of money off of what I'm doing. And nobody in that office can do even like nobody's going to replace me at this job. But I also kind of am not as driven to huck myself off something that's potentially dangerous. Like I know what can happen. So you let off the gas a little bit but you're saying it took you until now to start reflecting on that because yeah, that makes sense. You were go, go, go during that. Probably all the way through your whole career, right? Like, I don't remember you slowing down. Yeah,
until I had kids, you know what? But then once I had kids and it was like, okay, you know, there's a lot more on the line now, you mm-hmm. know? And so I made choices after that. Like, I think I became pretty good at evaluating risk because of experience. You know, once I hit, you know, when I was still snowboarding at about 28, 29 years old, you could really had seen enough to know what was acceptable risk and what wasn't. Mm-hmm. And it was like, okay, well, I could do that line. What's the worst that could happen? You know, okay, there's a little bit of rock exposure there. I could fall through that. And I always was really careful to make sure that there wasn't a giant patch of snow, like a big open face that was mm-hmm. going to funnel and bottleneck. And so it was just really about terrain evaluation after that mm-hmm. to make sure that you kind of mitigated any kind of death consequences to yes. some degree.
Yeah.
And then you can make everything look super sensational, but you could also remove the risk.
Right.
And when I was younger, I didn't have that sense. Mm-hmm. You know, I probably put myself into a lot scarier situations that I was not aware of
right
at the time until, you know, kind of a culmination of experience and ability came together. And then you were able to sort of, you know, have some control over your environment, not tons, but, it was enough to kind of stay alive,
yeah,
but it wasn't enough to keep me from getting injured.
What was your injuries? Did you have surgeries and things like that? Or
so many, two knee surgeries,
oh, wow.
four shoulder surgeries, oof. You know, yeah, broken arms and bones. And so it came with some lumps and bumps for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear about, you know, that you talked about the first trip to Alaska. You did many more. Is there a trip to Alaska with a crew that just stands out in your mind as, like, you know, the best trip that you ever had?
Well, you know, Alaska was fun, but it probably wasn't my top destination I ever traveled to.
Right.
So it was, Alaska had so much weather. It was, you'd go up there for literally 3 weeks to a month and ride 4 days sometimes.
Right.
Well, there was just so, you know, it could be epic. You get up there and you just hit it right and it's all time. And then you can go there and sit in your hotel room for 3 weeks straight, literally, and not even touch the snow. And then when you're asked to go out there, you're like super rusty and
right. Yeah.
You know, crusty. And it's like, okay, well, that wasn't very fun. That trip to Alaska kind of sucked. Which didn't happen. But, you know, I have to say one of the best trips was when we went to India.
Oh, wow.
That was all time, you know, Brad McGregor, Curtis Croy. We had, who were the riders there? Dave Bastachia.
Oh, wow.
Adam Hallstetter.
Sick.
Might've been Derek Height was there as well.
Rad.
And yeah. And you know, we were literally the first magazine snowboard film group to go to India. And we went to Himachal heli skiing up there, and we had no idea what we were getting into. It was literally, you know, like going snowboarding on Mars, in a way where you're like, what are we signed up for? So we got over there. We, obviously, you know, you're getting your tropical disease shots to go snowboarding. You're getting your, taking malaria medication and things like that. And it's like, seems really weird and surreal. Yeah. And then we get to the airport there, and within like, I don't know, literally 5 minutes, Curtis Croy somehow misplaced his passport, and he had to buy it back off someone.
Oh my God.
First 5 minutes of landing there, and we really just didn't know what we were doing. And we eventually, you know, get ourselves sorted, and it's an epic 3-day overland tour to get up into Himachal and the Kulu Valley. And there was road slides, and there was, you know, we had to spend a night in a town while they cleared the road, and they had the people out there by hand removing rocks and debris so that we could get by on these super sketchy mountain roads. And
whoa,
we eventually get to the heli ski operation, and it was just incredible. You know, we get our bearings, we finally kind of get settled, we get, you know, into this, and we fly up in the helicopter the first day, and it's just one of those like awe moments. And you're, mountains around you are like 22 to 24,000 feet.
Oh.
You're looking at these things, and it's just the most spectacular, surreal experience I've ever had.
That's incredible.
And yeah. And conditions were insane. They had like a storm cycle that came through just before we got there and dropped 3 meters of snow. So it was
wow.
Like, yeah. Yeah. So it was all time. It was so incredible up there. And I'm not, you know, I'm sure, you know, the footage or the photos from that trip truly represented how magical it was, but it was pretty much, you know, the top trip that I'd ever taken.
It sounds amazing. How was the food? Would have been pretty good food too.
Oh, the food, everything about it was so cool and so fun. Yeah, I loved it.
Good group of friends. Yeah, awesome place. Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah.
So,
and that just kind of, I should say, Eric, that just kind of just examples what snowboarding was for me. It was about the adventure. It was about the camaraderie with bros. And, you know, maybe in the beginning it was competition. You know, I think I felt like I had something to prove, or I wanted to prove something to myself. And then, you know, and I realized that I was not a very disciplined snowboarder in terms of, you know, training and competing in half pipes and learning tricks and all that kind of thing. I was like, you know what? I just want to go shred, and I just want to go see the world and adventure and travel around and do it with a bunch of rad bros. So that was
so lucky that time you nailed it. Like, you were in that very first wave of, you know, legitimate free riders, you know, Selaznik, Johan Olofsson, you know, even Farmer, Prada, all those guys.
Jay Liska.
I'm trying to think. There was a couple of Alaska guys that were crazy.
Yeah, we rode with all those guys. It was so cool, you know.
Unreal.
Rode with Farmer. Rode with Liska. Rode with everybody. Rode with Prada. Yeah. Rode with Sanders. Rode that. You know what? It was like, but that was like the changing of the guard, hey, when we were coming in. It was like they were kind of around, but you know, they were kind of in the twilight. And then this next generation, this next wave was coming along and kind of picked up the baton and took it from there.
Yeah. Yeah. Their generation was the big cliff generation. Steve Graham.
Goodwill.
Oh, Goodwill. Yeah. Grammy Cliff in Snowboarders in Exile. I love that. It's such a big cliff, dude. And I mean, even like that old Terry Kidwell shot at Wine Rock, like the biggest things that were going on in the first generation of pro riders was cliffs. And then you guys brought in big technical lines that looked beautiful, were filmed properly, good shots. And then freestyle stuff on top of that. So cliffs and lines, man, it's awesome. Did you witness a second changing of the guard? Like, was there a point where you're like, oh, wow, these kids coming up in the Whistler backcountry are crushing it?
You know, when I saw snowboarding change was probably the first time I saw Sean White.
Mm-hmm.
And it was at Hood. It was at summertime Hood. And here was a young kid, and he was destined for greatness, you could tell. But it was also interesting to see the support he had around him,
mm-hmm.
Through sponsors, through parents, through trainers, through nutrition. Like, from a very early age, it looked like Sean, you know, had everything that was needed to become what snowboarding is today. You know, like, it's interesting to think in the environment that we were in, we were just kind of a bunch of punk snowboarders who partied a bunch,
yeah,
who didn't really take it all that seriously. And we're just lucky for opportunity, you know, mm-hmm. because we were the first. And then that next wave came in and I'm like, oh, this is changing. There's way more athleticism coming into snowboarding, and you could see it. You could see it starting. And then it's become the sport it is today, you know. It's like I look at it today and I'm just in awe of what they're able to achieve on their snowboard.
Yeah, it's nuts.
Like, wow. Would I have had a career in this environment? It's hard to say, you know.
Would have been driven, like, and that does speak to something really big, right? Like, so there's a huge group of people that snowboard now, right? Like, so there weren't that many when we started out. And so, talent pool is definitely more aggressive and cutthroat. And you do need a nutritionist and a trainer and airbags and gymnastics coaches and things like that now. So, yeah, you don't know. And you would have had a phone, right? Like, so maybe you would have been really into video games. Who knows? It's, I feel so blessed when I think about how lucky we were when we picked up a snowboard. It literally was a ticket to travel around the world and say hey to other snowboarders and have such a good time no matter where you went. It's just, you don't have that anymore. They don't get that. It wouldn't be that fun to be coached into being an amazing snowboarder. I don't think.
Well, I think it'd be a lot more stressful, you know. There'd be anxiety and there'd just be more pressures. And you know what? A lot of guys, it's bigger money. So there's bigger responsibility to sponsors and
mm-hmm. yeah,
all the rest. So, I'm with you, dude. I high five you on the time that we had because it was, I think, in my opinion, kind of the golden years.
I agree, dude.
And you know, having pretty much unlimited travel budgets from K2 to just go do anything. I think in the biggest year I had, it was maybe 45 heli days in a season. And that was pretty common.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's just incredible. That's
I know.
Unbelievable. I'm sure there's pros that listen to the show that are pros right now that are like, wow, 45 heli days. You got to be shitting me. I know I heard Red Gerard talking about, maybe it wasn't Red. It was either Red or Sage Kostenberg. Both those guys won Olympic gold in half pipe, I think. I'm not that up to date on my competing stuff, but I heard them saying, you know, the dad was like, the parents were like, oh, you're quitting competition? Could you just go one more year and try for the Olympics? And then they won the Olympics. But like that just doesn't compute. Yeah. Like our parents weren't a part of the narrative. There was no support. We were supporting each other. And to be completely honest, we were not very good support for each other because it was like, you got to party as hard as you can.
Yeah. We lived that environment. It was whiskey's a testimony to that, right?
Like, totally.
That's where snowboard movies were in our day and age.
Yeah. So, and that was a pretty good representation of like what life was like as a snowboarder around North America at that time. You were watching movies, you were jumping off roofs, you were smashing bottles on your head and drinking a lot and not snowboarding that good, actually. If you look at the snowboarding in those movies, it's not great.
Yeah, but we had a lot of fun.
Oh, the best. It was the best.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with you on the golden time in snowboarding. Especially today with the crowds and the chaos, and then even just watching competitive snowboarding. Did you get a chance to watch any of that? Is it the natural selection? I can't remember what it's called. Natural selection, I think.
Yeah. You know what? I saw some highlights from it, and it was cool. I liked it because I'll tell you why. Because it made what we did when we were snowboarding seem somewhat relevant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the powder was a great equalizer for all of those riders in that. It was like, okay, you know what? You put them in a perfectly manicured, groomed environment, and it's like, okay, those guys, that's where they do their thing, right? But then you remove them from, you know, perfectly groomed in-runs and lips and stuff like that, and all of a sudden you're in terrain that requires, like, some serious riding just to get to the next hit.
Yeah.
and then the preparation, and then, you know, it's like, oh, you hit a bump and it throws you off a little bit. And then being able to actually do tricks like in that environment, it was there. They weren't chucking triple corks. You know, they were lucky to get a 720 off half of those lips. And
totally.
I was like, okay, you know what we were doing wasn't so far off.
Right. Totally. You know? Yeah. That would have been your event, right? Like that's basically.
I missed that. That would have been for me the best. If something like that existed when I was riding, I'm like, that's where I would have found a home and that kind of stuff. Yeah.
I think that's why that event is so awesome, is that it actually kind of translates to the regular Joe TV watching guy. Like, oh, of course this is what you would want. You would want a course where they haven't groomed anything. They built all these natural features, and you're going to get to hit it on a powder day top to bottom? Are you kidding me? That's like the ultimate snowboarding. There's nothing better than that.
Yeah.
I can't imagine.
Yeah, no, it was.
Yeah.
It was. It was so cool to see. And you know what's interesting? And when I look at it, I go, okay, well, those guys are so used to setting an edge when they come off a lip.
Mm-hmm.
And when you ride powder, you can't do that. You have to ride almost flat base off everything. So it kind of changes the way you do everything. And it's these subtle things in snowboarding that I can pick up on, but I don't think a lot of people really understand how hard it was
to do.
The tricks that we did in natural environment. And never having seen the lip before half the time. Like, okay, well, there's that wind lip. It looks pretty rad. It might be set up perfect for a frontside spin. I'll be like, okay, I'll give her a try.
I love that.
And the terrain would just dictate what you were going to do in a line or in a run. And it was like, you just had to be in communion with your environment when you rode stuff like that. And that was just what was magical. It's like, that's when you felt like you were truly in the zone, when you were just free riding a mountain and it was just presenting itself to you and you were just adapting and flowing with all that terrain as it came at you. And it felt unbelievable. It was the best sensation on earth.
Oh, it's the best. Yeah. I can remember my favorite trick for a long time was in Subject Hawkinson. He rolls up to a natural feature and pulls, I think if I'm correct, it's a front three perfectly. Perfect takeoff, perfect landing. But upon further notice, like on the 100th time of watching it, I noticed a ghost of a track. Like he'd done it the day before and there'd been a reset. And I was like, oh, I totally thought that was just like a, I thought it was his, you know what I mean? Like there's some magic to the movie making for sure. And oh my God.
Yeah, there can be.
Yeah, yeah, there can be. And so you did get to ride with Johan as well, right? Like I think that guy kind of was not that. Not saying that he's not Terrier. Terrier wasn't cheating. It just was an awesome shot that to me lost a little bit of it.
Unbelievable. That guy, he was athletic genius. Like he really was. I've rode with him in Alaska.
Yep.
And I've rode with him a couple times and really he just had something that very, very few riders had. The unbelievable reflexes. He was untouchable in so many ways. Like we would be at the lodge at the end of the day and try and play chess against them. And he'd just smoke you in chess. And then you try and play ping pong against them and it's just smoky and ping pong. And it's like, are you kidding me? Like, is there anything you're not the best in the world at? It was pretty, pretty cool. You know, like, you know, being able to, you know, just to see it. And that's, you know, again, like I actually, not that I had any kind of disdain for snowboard videos, but I saw so much of it live.
Right.
That, actually watching the video was just kind of like, oh, well, it's way cooler to see it live. I'll just like, I'm just like, okay, well, I'll just continue to see it live then. And I actually, you know what? I didn't even watch that many snowboard videos, which is kind of funny.
Yeah, no, I could see that. Most film days are going to be, you know, maybe a little bit stressful and definitely not like flowing top to bottom lines. So I can imagine, yeah, maybe an aversion to videos. When did you transition out of being a pro rider? Because you were a rep in BC for a while, right? I remember seeing you up Grouse, and you were a rep. And I was like, dude, I'm a huge fan. You're like, oh, right on, thanks.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know what I was doing.
Or maybe you were still riding for someone. Did you transition out of K2 to any other brand?
I went K2 to Arc'teryx.
Yeah, that's what it was.
I was riding K2 Arc'teryx, and then
must have been a design meeting for Arc'teryx or something.
Oh, it was too. It was something up on Grouse. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, I just remember seeing you and being like, "Fucking Brian Savard on Grouse! I can't believe it."
Grouse can be super fun, dude. I've had some nice nights out there.
Yeah, me too. Yeah,
I've been up there with Barnum before and had some fun.
Yeah, Barnum knew Grouse. He was one of the Grouse guys for sure. There's some great fall on at Grouse. I had a good day there. Actually, I had a good morning there this morning, but I had a good day there last Friday. We had a bit of a pow day. They're great. The really positive people up there too. Like the mountain staff is super sick. Same with Seymour. Both places are really friendly, really fun to ride at. Good community.
Yeah. And just being having access that's so close that you can actually just hop on your board, you know, or hop in your car and get up there and in a short time and go snowboard. And if it sucks, you take two runs and you go down or whatever. You got to pass. So it's like you can.
It's true, man.
Take your days. You know, it doesn't have to be an epic adventure to go find snow all the time.
Right. Yeah. Well, that was the thing was today, like I said, big storm slab day. So I've got a sled now, but I was like, you know what? I'll just go do a local day, which also gets a little bit ruined when you have a sled. Cause it's like, oh, I know there's good stuff. Sled access, like such good stuff. It kind of, but then it's a balance game too, because some of the best lines I've ridden this year were sledding, but then getting out from the zone was so gripping that I can't really remember how good the snowboarding was. I just get home and I pass out. Cause I'm like, Wow, that was like a 12-hour day. I think we had four runs or something, you know?
Yeah, and that nasty sled ride trumped the snowboarding.
Totally. What kind of sleds did you run? Did you run Ski-Doos or Polaris?
Early on, it was an Arctic-Cat. It was a Powder-Cat, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had a Polaris RMK 800 was my sled that I kind of finished my sledding time on.
Yeah.
And that was just such a good tool for getting around in the backcountry in Whistler and just being able to experience all that environment.
Yeah, I think a dude was on one of those the other day, 2010 or something, RMK.
Yeah, mine was a 2004.
Oh,
so
wow.
I finished, when I left Whistler, we moved up from Whistler to Comox in 2005, and I brought my sled over to the island,
mm-hmm.
and that was one of, like, less than five snowmobilers of what I could see.
Yeah.
And I went out one day
and
I toured around and I sled it. And I'm like, the next day I put my sled for sale. I was like, this is not snowmobiling. And, you know, no offense to the island snowmobilers, but, you know, coming from where I was and what I was doing on my sled and what kind of terrain we had access to, I was like, okay, then that's done. And to be honest, you know, at the end, I was over the noise, mm-hmm. over the two stroke smoke, because we were still running two stroke sleds then. And, it was like, okay, you know, I much preferred being on my split board or just hiking.
Oh, cool.
It was definitely, the noise kind of got to me after a while. I'm like, this is such a beautiful, serene environment. And then just hearing sleds
grooving
all over the place, it just kind of, I don't know, it just kind of took a little bit away from it, you know?
I could see that. So how often do you snowboard nowadays? You still get a couple of trips in with the family or?
Oh, well, we got the local hill here on the island. So I got a season's pass and I get up whenever it's decent enough to, you know, make the trip up there. So I'll get up, I don't know, I've been up like 6-8 times this year.
Oh, that's dope.
Yeah.
And do the kids know that their dad was this international snowboard pro? Are there pictures of you up on your wall or is that you're just dad?
Oh, They were aware.
Good.
They were definitely aware.
Yeah.
You know, through the years growing up. And they, I don't think, you know, they never really got to see me do it at that point. I was just like, they were probably a bit too young to remember. It was definitely hard to get them out in that environment. They saw videos, of course, but that's just like a guy with a toque riding down a snowy face. So it's really even hard to tell it's their dad, you know. So I think they're pretty somewhat impressed by it.
Yeah, good.
It's hard to know. We have these lives, and then all of a sudden we're a snowboarder. Then you become a father, and you become a parent, and then you know those things kind of tend to supersede some of the other stuff.
Absolutely.
And then it kind of reprioritizes how you look at life. And I don't really think I would have had as good of a career as I had I not had the support on the back end too, you know, an amazing wife that supported me along the way. She kind of kept me grounded, kind of tethered, you know?
Yes.
So that, you know, it was always something that I was working towards, you know, our relationship or, you know, our house or our family and that kind of thing. So that was a true compliment to, you know, what I was able to achieve was kind of built on, the environment around me.
Oh, you're so lucky. Yeah, that's dope.
Safe and secure. And then my kids come along and, you know, and then in the beginning, it's like, okay, new purpose, you know, holy smokes. I got, you know, I got family to support. So it kind of just put a fire under my butt and really got me going with snowboarding and had some amazing years. And then, through that process, you know, eventually, you know, I had to throttle back years of getting injured, you know, spending a whole season of going super hard. And then all of a sudden your whole summer's just turned into a recovery summer, whether you have to get a surgery to repair something or, you know, or you're just spending the summer just kind of chilling out from a giant winter. And then, it eventually transitioned into, you know, a life building skate parks. And I think what I did on my snowboard exampled to my children what can be done with a life. And I think it showed them that they don't have to take a linear path. And I think it gave them courage and showed them there's other opportunities out there. So I just have to say I'm so proud of the paths my kids have chose and right. the young men they've become. You know, I've got my older son who's in auto sports now.
Cool.
He was an active skateboarder, active snowboarder, and now he's in Calgary and he's designing aerodynamic parts for sports cars.
Wow.
And so he's picked a path that just like his passion is that industry. And so he's designing like splitters and spoilers and different wide body kits for cars and different things like that. So it's really cool what he's done. And he's, you know, he's self-trained. It's just like, okay, well, here's something new that, you know, he came from the drift scene. So he's just like, okay, I want to start be in this industry. And then he's turned it into a career in creating parts for cars, which is really cool. And my younger son is athletic and my wife put him in dance.
Nice.
And he's actually now dancing at the Royal Winnipeg Ballet.
Are you serious? That is so impressive.
Yeah. So Logan's dancing in Winnipeg and Jordan is building car parts in Calgary. And yeah, I couldn't be more proud of the dad of what they've done with their lives.
Dude, that is so sick. Far. That's really dope, dude. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's rad. So what are you doing now? You're building skate parks? That's so sick because it goes back to the ramp in the backyard.
Yeah, totally. It's kind of where it all started for sure. So it's kind of a return to my original roots, I guess. Yeah.
Rad.
Yeah. And I just kind of traded snow powder for cement powder, you know?
Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
What kind of parks do you like to build? Are you like transition parks? Are you like,
I prefer building transition parks.
Yep.
But we build everything.
Yeah.
So we'll do we'll do plazas and ledge forming and we'll do, you know, we'll do tranny parks and bowls and all that kind of stuff. So
sick.
I like everything about it.
And now you're back on the traveling around the world thing too, right? Because I guess projects
pop
up here and there.
Yeah. So yeah, that was, you know, what, it was hard. You know, I'd say there was probably two or three really hard years after transitioning out of a professional career in snowboarding.
Yeah.
That was just, you're just kind of left kind of figuring out what direction you go after that. You kind of have to reinvent yourself. You know, I left the place that I identified with in Whistler. It was, you know, snowboarding was, there was some ego associated with snowboarding. And then here you are. Okay. Like I'm in a place now where I have to provide for my family and, you know, have to figure out what my next chapter is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
But I definitely knew I was done snowboarding at that time. I was consciously chose to leave snowboarding because I had exhausted everything I wanted out of it. You know, I kind of dabbled in maybe some industry stuff and there was just nothing that fit at all. So I was like, okay, well, let's sort of figure out something else that's going to work for me. And then one day, you know, kind of out of the blue, Barnum called me up and he said, there's a park going in Courtney. Do you want to work on it? And I'm like, you know, he said, I was a builder at the time. So I was doing home building and renovations and that kind of thing. He's like, Brian, you skate and you're a builder. Like this would be a perfect fit for you.
Rad.
And so he put me onto that project and I was like, yeah, this is cool. I like doing this. It was really fun. And I started that just as a worker on that park in 2005. And then I just kind of dabbled a little bit after that. And then finally started a company in 2008 called Radius Contracting. And from there, it kind of just grew and grew and grew and kind of turned into my new profession, my new business, my new passion.
That's so sick. Yeah, we need more skate parks. I mean, there's so much exposure for kids to skateboarding media
Yeah.
But like the number of parks in Vancouver isn't enough even for a skateboard, you know, crazy town like we are.
I've seen, it's been a great business to be in. It kind of feels a lot like what we were doing snowboarding in a way. You know, we'd travel as a crew of guys to a new location. You know, you'd be in a new community, you'd meet the skateboarders of that community, like we would meet the snowboarders of Aspen if we went there, or the snowboarders of, you know, Tehran when we went to Iran, or, you know, like all these, you're just making new friends, but just, it's closer to home. So I get to see, now I get to see all of Canada, you know, literally been to almost every corner of Canada.
Cool.
Experienced all these amazing, great communities across our country. And it's been really, really fun and exciting and rewarding. So I'm happy with my decision.
I love it.
That's hasn't so come sick. Without its challenges.
Right.
You know, it's been, it hasn't been easy all the time, that's for sure, but it's pretty cool.
Dude, you've had such an awesome life in board sports. That's incredible. I'm so glad that I called you yesterday. I was like, I think I probably would have called you 3 or 4 years ago on that same landline phone. And you were stunned in the exact same way. Like, hey, man, legend of snowboarding. I got a podcast. You want to do it? I think you were like, yeah, maybe last time.
Yeah, you know, I wasn't a big guy for attention. You know, I was just like, that part of my life's done.
Right.
I was kind of just over it at that point. And I was like, okay, maybe, you know, and I don't know. I just don't think what I have to say is very important either. So
I think it's really important. I think it'll be inspiring to up and coming snowboarders. And we had the best of the days, the best of them.
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you so much for doing the show. Let's keep in touch. If I'm ever over at Mount Washington, I'd love to link up with you and ride. That'd be fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, it's been great. And, you know, thanks for the opportunity to tell a bit of my story. I would just like to speak to the fact that I don't really think I would have had as good of a career as I had I not had the support on the back end too. You know, I didn't, you know, didn't necessarily have trainers and stuff like that, but I had an amazing wife that supported me along the way. She kind of kept me grounded, kind of tethered, you know?
Yes.
So that, you know, it was always something that I was working towards, you know, our relationship or, you know, our house or our family and that kind of thing. So that was a true compliment to, you know, what I was able to achieve was kind of built on, the environment around me.
Oh, you're so lucky. Yeah, that's dope.
Safe and secure. And then my kids come along and, you know, and then in the beginning, it's like, okay, new purpose, you know, holy smokes. I got family to support. So it kind of just put a fire under my butt and really got me going with snowboarding and had some amazing years. And then, through that process, you know, eventually, you know, I had to throttle back years of getting injured, you know, spending a whole season of going super hard. And then all of a sudden your whole summer's just turned into a recovery summer, whether you have to get a surgery to repair something or, you know, or you're just spending the summer just kind of chilling out from a giant winter. And then, it eventually transitioned into, you know, a life building skate parks. And I think, what I did on my snowboard, exampled to my children what can be done with a life. And I think it showed them that they don't have to take a linear path. And I think it gave them courage and showed them there's other opportunities out there. So I just have to say I'm so proud of the paths my kids have chose and the young men they've become. You know, I got my older son who's in auto sports now.
Cool.
He was an active skateboarder, active snowboarder, and now he's in Calgary and he's designing aerodynamic parts for sports cars.
Wow.
So he's picked a path that just like his passion is that industry. And so he's designing like splitters and spoilers and different wide body kits for cars and different things like that. So it's really cool what he's done. And he's, you know, he's self-trained. It's just like, okay, well, here's something new that, you know, he came from the drift scene. So he's just like, okay, I want to start be in this industry. And then he's turned it into a career in creating parts for cars, which is really cool. And my younger son is athletic, and my wife put him in dance.
Nice.
And he's actually now dancing at the Royal Winnipeg Ballet.
Are you serious? That is so impressive.
Yeah. So Logan's dancing in Winnipeg, and Jordan is building car parts in Calgary. And yeah, I couldn't be more proud of the dad of what they've done with their lives.
Dude, that is so sick. Far. That's really dope, dude.
Evan Rad shout outs this week to Brian and his family. Thanks for doing the show, Brian. My great friend runs Tomahawk Indigenous Cannabis Extracts, so Google that and get the topical pain cream with CBD. I've been putting it on my sore ankle for a few days since it arrived, and I gotta tell you, it's working. I love it. It's awesome. Buy Salmon Arm mitts. And seriously, if you're riding cotton socks, get at least one pair of Stance snowboarding socks right now. It'll change your life. And be sure to come back next week for another episode of the Effin' Rad Snowboard Podcast, presented by Vans and brought to you by SIA Productions.